Affairs Office of the EPA. So as the EPA moves to repeal these environmental safeguards, you literally have oil and gas lobbyists who've spent the last, you know, 3 to 4 years fighting this regulation, now in charge of repealing it.
Does Ford's going to have to go through congressional approval, Leifang?
No, and that's kind of an interesting dynamic here.
We have 5 seconds.
No, he does not. He's a deputy administrator, and the EPA has been pushing through a lot of deputy roles that do not require Senate confirmation.
We'll leave it there, but we're going to interview you about other issues and post it at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. Coming up next is Voices from the Edge with Joanna Hardesty.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Engineering Committee will meet on the first Wednesday at 7 p.m.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Avenue Q, produced by Triangle Productions. The play runs from June 8th through July 1st at the Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza in Portland. Avenue Q is a musical that tells the story of Princeton, a recent college grad who moves into a shabby New York apartment and meets other residents. Together, they struggle to find jobs, dates, and their ever-elusive purpose in life. Again, that's Avenue Q from June 8th through July 1st at the Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza, 1785 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This program is made possible by KBOO members and support from Open Signal, Portland Community Media Center, a nonprofit media arts center dedicated to helping Portlanders amplify their voices. Open Signal offers programs to media makers, including classes, artist residencies, exhibition opportunities, artist talks, film screenings, media fellowships, and more. Learn how you can get involved at opensignalpdx.org. This program is also made possible by Street Roots, for those who cannot afford free speech. Street Roots creates income opportunities for people experiencing homelessness and poverty by producing a newspaper published weekly in Portland, Oregon, and other media that are catalysts for individuals and social change. Online at streetroots.org.
Get up, stand up.
Hey, let's go.
Stand up for your right.
Good morning, good morning. Welcome to Voices from the Edge. I am Joanne Hardesty, your host. I've got a few things I want to talk about today. First, let's talk about the police response to Good in the Hood. Good in the Hood, for those who don't know, has been a primarily African-American festival for the last 20-odd years in the city of Portland. It started off as a fundraiser to provide scholarships for young folks to be able to go to a private school in that area. And it has grown into one of the big multicultural festivals in the city of Portland. Prior to last weekend, there were a couple of reports of potential disruption by hate groups who sent a letter to the director of Good in the Hood, suggesting that he and other black folks would be injured or harmed if they participated in that festival. And as is the case in Portland, the response was police. The response was FBI. The response was a military response to a implied threat. And so I want to have a little conversation about that today, because I believe that there is a total unawareness by white middle class Oregonians when it comes to threats against people of color. I think that there is a blinders are on, and people think that when a threat like this comes in, that we somehow all panic. And it's really white middle class Oregonians who panic, because communities of color are under attack and threat on a regular basis in Oregon. And we have seen that play out over and over and over again. As the president of the NAACP Portland branch, I expect to always get threatening letters, phone calls, emails. I get them. I share them with my leadership. I may tell the general membership that we got another idiotic letter from some idiot who wants attention. But I never hold a press conference. I never call Portland police, A, because I don't think they'll do anything, and B, I don't demand more law enforcement. What Oregonians have to know, especially white middle-class Oregonians, is police force, excessive police, do not equate to safety in communities of color. And let me give you a great example. You may have seen the news coverage of the cell phone footage of the white woman driving yesterday in a stolen car down Burnside by Powell's Books. You may have noticed that she was surrounded by four or five police officers, and they had a police four-wheel drive vehicle that had her, they thought, blocked in. As they tried to get information from her, she drove off. She had police officers hanging off the door. They chased her. She got away. And they ultimately found her and arrested her. I share this story because it's been only a month since on the Max line, a African-American man was running away from two Portland police officers and got shot in the back and has been cleared of all wrongdoing in his death. Now, I did not want that white woman who stole the car to die at the hands of the police, but it doesn't go unnoticed the difference in police response when you're dealing with black people or brown people as compared to white people. I want to remind you that Kendra James lost her life 12 years ago now, under the same kind of situation. She tried to drive off in a car. She was a passenger, jumped into the driver's seat, and the officer pulled his gun and shot her because he was trying to prevent her from driving off. So we're talking 12 years difference, a black woman and a white woman. And the difference by law enforcement is as different as night and day. And so we have to stop pretending that somehow police equal safety because they almost never do when they come and respond to incidents that involve people of color. As I watch the news play out around the Good in the Hood, as I listen to the police and the FBI and Homeland Security and all these people, all these law enforcement agencies decide that they were going to show up in force to protect us, we don't expect that from police. Police have never protected communities of color, and we certainly did not expect that to happen at Good in the Hood. I did not make it to Good in the Hood, so I want you, the listeners who went, to please call 503-231-8187 and tell me what you experienced there. Was there a large police presence? Did you feel like you were at a festival, or did you feel like you were under martial law? I would love to know, because I didn't get the chance to go. Way too busy a weekend. But it still feeds into this narrative that somehow this threat the response should be that we have more police. Just like after the murders on TriMet, the first response was, we need more police officers at TriMet. No, we don't. We have too many police officers at TriMet now. My example is the one I gave a little while ago of the black man shot in the back as he was running away from TriMet officers. It's ironic to me that we have not heard. I know that those two officers involved were brothers who worked for different police agencies. We have not had any kind of analysis about whether or not the shooting was related to protecting a family member rather than those police officers feeling any danger or feeling any threat from a black man running away. And he was running away. Allegedly, he had a knife before. I want to know how we got to a place where a knife, a cell phone, any sudden movement means that you are sentenced to death by police officers. I thought we hired police to maintain public safety, and their job is not to be the judge, the jury, and the executioner. Their job is merely to contain people involved in criminal behavior and then turn them over to the justice system. That is their job, and they are so far out of their lane nowadays, and it appears that the public has been absolutely silenced by this very militarized, very aggressive, very arrogant police force that we have. I'm not saying, and before you start calling and complaining, not saying every police officer on the force fits that criteria, but I will say that I am very, very concerned in how police show up anywhere in the city of Portland. They show up in a very, very aggressive manner. For protests, they show up as if they are headed to a war zone. And when you show up as if you're headed to a war zone, then the expectation is you're going to get to use those toys that you brought with you. And those toys include those flash bombs that somehow has become normalized when police are trying to disperse crowds. I think that we in the city of Portland are knee deep in our search for the next police chief. And I got to tell you, if I hear that we have hired a police chief who does not have a value of really engaging the community around how they want to be policing, there will be a lot more protests around policing in the city of Portland. I mean, I think we have to get a handle on what we, the community, want in policing, and then we have to demand it from our city council. I absolutely believe that Mayor Wheeler is interested and committed to reforming the police bureau. But I also think that he is very influenced by what police tell him. And if you aren't out there observing police actions, if you're not witnessing what's taking place, then you would also be under the false illusion that somehow any protest is a violent protest and therefore needs a aggressive police response. I have been just mortified at how policing has changed just in my time here in the city of Portland. And my observation was that the last police commissioner that we had, Charlie Hales, actually gave the police everything they wanted. They have brand new vehicles. I mean, we live in the city of Portland. Why do police officers need four-wheel drive trucks to patrol the city of Portland? Brand new. Why do they need that? This year was the worst snow that we've ever had in the city of Portland in its history, right? And so I can understand on those days, but most of the time in the city of Portland, you don't need four-wheel drive vehicles to drive through the city of Portland. We know that they have purchased huge weapons. I mean, who authorized the purchase of flash bombs? Who decides when flash bombs are thrown into crowds? And what we don't know yet is how they impact people long term. I mean, the chemical weapons that Portland police officers currently deploy at protests are really, really frightening. When you think about the canisters, and you know, they used to have these little canisters that would be on their belt. When they come to protest, they come with, like, there must be a 10-gallon canister that they obviously plan to use on community members. And who makes that decision? And why would we make that decision that tear gassing community members is a matter of public safety? And so I think the new police chief is just the very first step and what we need. But after we get the new police chief, we need a community conversation about how we want to be policed and what we think is appropriate and isn't appropriate when it comes to policing. I have been just so frustrated over the last few years because since Sam Adams left office, and I didn't agree with everything that Sam Adams, police commissioner, did, but Sam Adams really was the last police commissioner that really tried to redirect Portland police officers in a way that would have been less aggressive and less violent. And what I know is he was the last police commissioner that really asked police hard questions and made them accountable to the public. I don't think we've got that kind of accountability right now. And because, of course, we've got Chief Marshman, who really, everything's fine as far as he's concerned. So he would love to be police chief permanently, as would Daryl Turner, the Portland Police Association's president, would love to have him as the permanent police chief. Now, Mike Marshman is a nice, decent guy, but he's not going to make Portland Police do anything different. He is a guy that is going to just go along to get along. He just wants to be friends with everybody, but there is not an aggressive bone in his body when it comes to holding police accountable for inappropriate behavior for community members. I just want to go back to yesterday. I mean, James Perez was shot and killed and by Portland police officers back in, I think it was 2008. He was shot and killed in a very similar situation to the woman in the car yesterday. But what was interesting is he was shot and killed because just like Philandro, he was actually reaching for his wallet and the police officer was scared and guess what? Shot and killed him. Now, why was he stopped? He was stopped because he was driving a car that the police thought didn't fit the neighborhood that he was driving in. And so when he was following directions, doing what he was told, he was shot and killed. This happens over and over and over again. I don't even watch the videos anymore. I mean, the latest case of Shalina Lyles in Seattle, where... you know, a woman calls the police for help because she thinks somebody is breaking into her house. Two officers show up, and a short while later, she's dead. Pregnant woman with three kids, and she's dead because she called the police for help. We see this all over the country. But, you know, people ask me if there are models of good policing, and I have actually finally found one. Because I had been searching, I kept saying, there's got to be a police department somewhere on the planet that's actually doing this right. And I actually did find a police department that appears to be an example of how you transform a police department into one that values all life and not just their own lives. And that is the Camden Police Department in New Jersey. Now, if you know anything about Camden, New Jersey, it is a very poor neighborhood. It is a high crime area. It is primarily African American. And up until a few years ago, the only time the police showed up was to arrest people and really had no relationship with the community at all. Over the last few years, however, they have a new leader, a new police chief, who has a philosophy of the sanctity of all life. And I watched this program the other night where they showed a man with a knife that was walking down the street threatening people. Now, you know, we know how what the outcome would be if this happened in Portland and pretty much any other city in the United States of America. I still can't figure out why police can't contain people with knives, because knives don't actually, they don't fly like bullets do. So I don't understand why police officers aren't trained to be able to take a knife from people. But having said that, in Camden, I watched what I thought was model police behavior. And so here's a guy with a knife, clearly distressed, clearly agitated, and there must have been six police officers on the scene. And what I watched was how these police officers talked to him very calmly. Only one of those six officers had their weapon drawn and ready to shoot if necessary. The other five officers were merely just kind of trying to circle him in a way to make sure that no community member was hurt, that the gentleman wasn't hurt that had the knife that was agitated. And I watch what I believe is like the best policing that I have ever seen. And I watched this police officer, and here's the thing. In this case, they knew what police officer was in charge. There was one lead police officer. All the other police officers were following the lead police officer's lead. Only one of the other officers had their weapon drawn, and he was out of visual sight of the gentleman with the knife. And so they're following him down the street. They are circling him, a very wide circle, so they're not agitating him. They're circling him. They're talking to him in a very calm manner. And ultimately, they were able to talk him down and have him put the knife down. But what the chief said was that the goal was to make sure that this man did not lose his life. That because he had a knife, because he was agitated, because he was threatening people, was not a reason for him to lose his life. And so we have models. We have a model. I haven't seen any other police department with that kind of certainty about what the role of policing should be. And so I was thrilled to now know that there is, in fact, a model of what could happen. But guess what? It can happen only if the leadership sends clear messages to the rank and file about what the expectations are, what they will and will not accept, and that they value all life. And so anytime anybody loses their life, there will be a deep investigation as to what went wrong. And so we're going to go to the phone line. Good morning, Francis. Welcome to KBOO. Good morning. Good morning, Francis.
Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Hi, I'm good. And thank you for the conversation this morning.
You're welcome.
One thing I wanted to remember, people to remember about Kendra James also was that she was shot in the hip and she was left to bleed to death internally on that overpass. She was complaining, asking for help. And what I can remember in one of the statements by the officers, they said they thought she was faking.
They thought she was faking?
Yes.
When she was begging for help?
Right.
Well, didn't he know he shot her?
Yeah, but, you know, she's only shot in the hip. But she had internal injuries similar to what that senator just had recently that was shot. And the same sort of situation. But she was not given medical treatment soon enough to take care of her. But I agree with you on everything you've just said. I feel that the criminal justice system throughout, from the beginning, from arrests on the street to the courts, to the county jail, to incarceration, to closed street supervision, all of it should be repealed and replaced. But that'll be wishful thinking on my part. Right. One thing that I wanted to point out, I'm not going to talk too long, but I just wanted to say that to the training that the police officers receive is all about escalating and perpetrating violence.
Yes.
And also, there's no screening, there's no vetting of people. You know, as far as I'm concerned, if someone is unable to control their emotions or is a racist, they should not even be on the police force. They shouldn't be allowed to be among us in our communities with those big old guns on their hips. But the thing that this had nothing to do with the shooting, it had to do with the manner in which people are being treated and the value of life.
Yes.
The video that bothered me the most of all of these videos, like you said, I don't watch those videos anymore. But the one where it was after Philando Castile was killed, and his wife and the baby were in the back seat of a police car.
Right.
For some reason, she had to be handcuffed, the woman. I don't know why.
Right.
She wasn't under arrest.
That's right. She didn't do anything, right.
She had just witnessed her old man being blown away.
Right.
And her little baby girl is in there consoling her.
Yes.
She's handcuffed. She can't even hug her child.
Right. That's right.
And the manner and the way the little girl spoke to her was so beautiful.
Yes, it was.
And how she took care of her mother. And the fact that the police officer told her he had to wait for a supervisor before he could take the handcuffs off. He didn't wait for a supervisor to put the handcuffs on her.
That's right.
And he didn't wait for a supervisor to blow somebody away. So that right there said so much about the entire system and how totally foul and
corrupt and
inhumane it is.
Yes, yeah, right. We've lost the humanity in policing in the United States. You're absolutely right. And when you talk about the training, when you go to the training facility, you start to understand why police work the way they do, because it's just like military boot camp. It is exactly like military boot camp. When you see them marching in formation and, you know, standing at attention.
And the fear that they, for someone to have that much fear.
Right.
You know, and to say it's fear, I don't know that it always is.
I don't think
no. They don't screen out the racists in there either. But there's a lot that needs to be done. I agree with you.
Yeah, well, thank you so much.
All right, you too.
You too. I appreciate your call, and I appreciate your continued advocacy. Have a great day.
You too.
Thank you. Bye. Talking about the psychology of policing, I think it's really important that we, the community, remember that there is one man in Portland who's a psychologist who is primarily responsible for approving all the people that become police officers in this area. I know Washington, Clackamas, Multnomah County, and his name is Dave Corey. And I remember back in, when was it? It was 2012 that we realized that this psychologist who lives in Lake Oswego had been getting contracts from the city of Portland that had been automatically renewed for 13 years solid. And so you think about a population as large as the population in the Portland metro area, you think about how many psychologists are licensed in the state of Oregon, and you'd have to wonder, why would we have one man in Lake Oswego deciding the psychological fitness of Portland police officers, and police officers, quite frankly, throughout the three-county area? I mean, he has all these contracts sold up. And so there must be a reason for that. He must give these law enforcement agencies exactly the type of candidates that they want. And so in 2012, though, we realized that at that time, former Portland Police Chief Mike Reese had tried to slip through the city council a new 10-year contract for Dr. David Corey. And yet, what he did, it was hysterical, because
I just happened to be at the city council, as was Dan Handelman with Portland Cop Watch, to testify on something. And we heard Mike Reese come in and say to the city council, we need to extend Dr. Dave Corey's contract, David Corey's contract, because we've got all these candidates in the pipeline and his contract expires and we need to extend it for 3 months. This goes to show how little the city council actually reads what comes in front of them. They are dependent on the people who present to them. So here we are sitting in the audience reading the city council ordinance, and come to find out, it wasn't a three-month extension. It was a brand new five-year contract. And so we pointed this out to the mayor, Sam Adams, at that time. And to his credit, he pulled it off of the council agenda. In addition to that, we forced him to actually rewrite the RFP so that there could be competition in who would get this contract to determine the psychological fitness of members to be police officers. You might be surprised. And so we did that. We got a new RFP. And surprise, surprise, there's been only one person doing it forever. So Dr. David Corey did get a new contract, but he didn't get the whole contract. He actually also, there was a subcontract to a person of color psychologist that the agreement was that they would work with David Corey over the 5 year period of time, and therefore there would be additionally qualified psychologists to be able to determine the fitness of Portland police officers. And by the way, that was in 2012. And so if my math serves me correctly, that means that that contract is about to come up again for renewal, which means that we, the public, need to make sure that that contract goes out for a full request for proposal, and that we get and that we go abroad to recruit people to actually apply for that contract, and that we make sure that we are expanding opportunities for other psychologists to determine whether or not police officers really are fit for duty. It just made me incensed to think that, you know, they got somebody they like, and so we're just going to, everybody's going to contract with this one guy. I don't know whether the guy is good or bad. All I know is that with the kind of police officers that we are now getting on the force, with the very aggressive, arrogant, dictatorial personalities, that clearly we have to go back to the beginning and rethink how we recruit police officers, how we train police officers, and how we deploy them into communities, how we make sure that they actually are being that we don't just use the catchphrase community policing, that we actually develop a community policing model that really puts the community and the police on equal footing, and so that we can tell you how we want to be policed. We are in a community where we should be the decision makers. The police are public servants that are supposed to work for us. Unfortunately, if you look throughout our criminal justice system, you know it only works for a small segment of our community. It certainly doesn't work for communities of color, certainly doesn't work for houseless people, certainly doesn't work for people who don't have political power at City Hall. And that is something that we, the public, absolutely have to change. And I've been very privileged to work with some incredible people over the last 20 years trying to make these changes happen. But my conclusion is that the racism is institutionalized. The racism is built into the system. It is built into the policies. And it absolutely is built into how policing happens and how communities get policed. You never hear about a riot squad going up into the Southwest Hills because there's a group of kids up there acting crazy. You don't hear about that. And the reason you don't hear about that is because that's not the way we respond when there's a police call in the Southwest Hills. We're going to go back to the phone line. Good morning, Steve. Welcome to KBOO. Good morning.
Good morning, Joanne. Love your work.
Thank you.
Yeah, I wanted to ask, have you ever done a ride along with police officers, and do you recommend that, or is that available to the public, and how that might happen?
It is available to the public, there, and I have done it a couple of times over the last 20 years. And it is available to the public. If you went to the Portland Police Bureau's website, you could even download the application. So there is an application. There is a background check that has to be done before you are able to participate. So they don't just let anybody ride along. They got to check you out before they allow you to spend some time on a police shift. But I would say, knowing all that, it is a real eye-opening experience, and of course, everything depends on the officer that you are matched with, but I think it gives you a very up-close and personal viewpoint about how policing happens in the city of Portland. I would certainly encourage that.
Well, thanks. I just want to say, I think of you as a window, a mirror, and an agitator, and in that regard, it's like sunlight is the best disinfectant.
Yes.
And if you take the agitator out of the washing machine, the dirty linen just floats on top.
That's right. Well, thank you very much. I like that analogy.
Take care.
You too. Have a great day. I also, let's see, what else did I want to say today about policing? We are right now, as you know, in the middle of a search for our next police chief. But I am already concerned because I had the privilege of meeting a police chief from Forest Grove, Oregon, who I thought, wow, here's a woman who is a police chief and believes in transparency. I mean, the quote that she said to me, we had a very brief conversation, and since then I've talked to her a couple of more times. But when a police chief says to you, I'm not afraid of transparency. If I'm doing my job right, I want you to see what I'm doing. I think transparency is a good thing. When a police chief says that to you, and they actually mean it, I think, whoa, what a great candidate for a Portland police chief. Then I found out that she was eliminated before the first round. And I thought, huh. Now, if I had this very positive interaction and perspective and just a brief conversation, how did she get eliminated from before the very first round of interviews took place? And so I have put in a request to the mayor's office to find out about that. As of yet, they have not responded. But you know me, I'm going to like just keep asking until I get the answers that I'm looking for. So I will keep you informed. I know the interviews are being set up as we speak. Next week, in the next few weeks, there will be interviews with potential candidates for Portland Police Chief. I would love that to happen out in the open. I'm not quite sure why we've taken this inside City Hall approach. I know why. Fear, because the police are really good at creating fear in city council members against community members. And of course, we have about five community members that get out of control every once in a while. So all of a sudden, we can't do community meetings because the city council is fearful that people may come and yell at them. I mean, you know, that's why we have people in elected office so that they can hear directly from the people that they serve. And so when they stop listening directly to the people they serve, it is time for us to do something different. And so it's my hope. I know that there are good people involved in the interview process. It is my hope that we come out with a fabulous new police chief. But I also want to say that the gentleman that turned around Camden, the one thing that I forgot to mention about the turnaround at Camden was that they dismantled the entire police force. That was how they were able to turn around this police force so effectively. And as you can imagine, the pushback was unimaginable when they dismantled the police force. But when you eliminate the entire police force and then you develop a new one and you have a police chief who values the sanctity of all life and you're only hiring people who share your worldview, guess what? You end up with a police force that doesn't think their guns and their weapons are their only mode of communicating with the public. I would love to see the kind of political leadership that would just fire our entire police force and start over. I'd love to see that. Do we have that? Not a chance in heck. But that would send a very strong message. We don't like what we've got, and we're going to eliminate it, and we're going to start over. That is huge. But it takes political courage. It takes people that are willing to do something radically different so that they can get radically different results. I think that is what it will take, at least in my mind, for us to have a police force that the public will respect and trust. When you fire them all and make them reapply, and then make them reapply, making sure that they share your value system, I think that you go a long way towards building the police force that you want. Now, you may remember that Charlie Hales gave 7 years of freebies to cops that we wanted to retire. They were about to sunset. They were finally going to leave. They were finally out of Portland Police Bureau. This is the old guard, the ones who believe in broken window policing, the ones who believe that you just beat people up because they didn't talk to you respectfully. They were headed to retirement, and to Charlie Hales gave them a sweetheart deal of 7 years of full employment at full salary in addition to their retirement. And so with no criteria for bringing them back on the force. And when asked, well, okay, so if we're going to bring back the people we've been desperately waiting to retire, what is the criteria? The response from Charlie Hales was, the criteria will be, it will be up to the police chief. Remember, the police chief that we have, Mike Marshman, just wants to make friends. We don't need a police chief that just wants to make friends. We need a reformist. We need a transformative leader that is absolutely clear that we have significant problems within our police force, and that they are the right leader at the right time to fix it. Don, I wish that we had just fired everybody and started over. I think we would have been a lot better off. But since we didn't go that route, let's figure out how to make sure that the police chief that is hired is acceptable to communities that have been most impacted by police violence, because that is key. You know, if you are, you know, middle class, upper middle class, if you're one of the new rich people that have moved to town, the chance of the police stopping you while you're going 90 miles an hour on the freeway or, you know, zooming past people, driving like a maniac, the chance of you getting stopped is pretty slim. I'm talking about the folks who've lived here for a while. I'm talking about communities of color. I'm talking about houseless people. I'm talking about the people with the least political power. How are you going to police them? That's how I will judge the next police chief. Not by how you're going to treat the rich folks, because the rich folks always get treated nicely. I'm going to go back to the phone line. Good morning, Dennis. Welcome to KBOO. Good morning.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. You brought up Camden, and then you brought up Camden again, and I just wanted to add my two bits about Camden. I learned from Chris Hedges. This was quite a while back. I'm sure you know who he is. He said that at the time that he was reporting this, that between 30 and 36,000 dock workers in Camden were laid off at that time.
Ah.
Now, it doesn't take an awful lot of thought to see that that's an explosive situation.
Right.
And if that city can pull their act together and, you know, get in, do this, what you said they do, that speaks a lot to the city of Camden, really.
Yes, it does. I mean, right. I mean, you're talking about a very poor community, a community with very limited resources, but they must have had some incredible political leadership to be able to even take the step of saying, this force is dysfunctional, and we're going to disband this force, and we're going to start over.
Yeah.
That's pretty powerful.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay. Appreciate your call.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye now. But yes, all it takes is like strong political leadership. All it takes is a vision of what's possible. All it takes is leadership at the top. And I'm pretty sure he didn't, but I was kind of hoping that the police chief in Camden had applied to come to Portland to help fix what's broken here. And so for the folks who are reading applications for Portland police chief, if you see Chief J. Scott Thompson in that pool, then you should move him to the top of the candidate pool and talk to him about taking this job. It is absolutely amazing when a city where you have 40% of the people living below the poverty line, when you have 9 square miles of abandoned buildings and worn row houses, that all of a sudden you have a neighborhood that actually welcomes police officers in, that actually works with police to solve crimes. Because guess what? They actually think that the police are partners with them to make their community better. I am so grateful that I actually found a police force, because I was getting depressed. The more people that asked me, well, is there a model? Have you seen it work anywhere? Now I can say, yes, I have. But what it takes is strong political leadership. What it takes is the willingness to actually fire everybody and start over. What it takes is a big picture vision of what's possible. And I think the number one thing it takes is a police chief that values everyone's life, that doesn't think police officers' lives are more valuable than the people they serve. I think that's the number one difference between what we've seen here in Portland and what Camden is experiencing after, quite frankly, some really horrific years of horrible policing, right? So it's not like they've always been this bright light in the storm. And in fact, as you can imagine, there are police agencies across the country that don't think highly of this particular police agency because of the radical changes that they have done. And if you think about it, you know, of course they don't want to see an entire police force get fired. But guess what? I mean, there's no way to say that you are a good police officer if you stand by watching the constitutional rights of people be violated. And on that note, there is a excellent Portland police officer who just announced his retirement. And he is someone that I've known for a lot of years. And he has had, he has been really harassed and maligned and really treated poorly by the police department in the last couple of years under this current leadership, under Mike Marshman's leadership. And that is Kevin Modica. Under Larry O'Day, he was an assistant chief. When Modica came in, he did away with all the people that were assistant chiefs under O'Day and made it look very much, with one exception, like what Mike Reese's leadership team looked like. Anytime Mike Reese showed up, there would be his top assistant chiefs were all white. They were all male. And they all were like, you know, early 40s or mid 40s. And so every time they showed up, you went, so that's Portland Police. It was, the visual was really stunning. And then O'Day became chief. O'Day was absolutely committed to reform. When he first was appointed chief, I told him to his face, I didn't think that anybody within Portland Police Bureau had the moxie to do the kind of reform that was necessary to make Portland Police function in a way that respected all community members. And I said, but if you're going to do it, I'm willing to work with you and I'll be your biggest fan. And if you don't, I'll be your biggest critic. And O'Day proved me wrong. He came from within the bureau. He did a great job of trying to really move forward a reform agenda. And I knew when he was being successful, because guess what? That's when a rank and file pushes back. All of a sudden, they weren't happy because all of a sudden now they got a chief that's trying to make them do things different than they are accustomed to doing them. But so under O'Day, Kevin Modica, the longest-serving African-American officer in Portland Police Bureau, became assistant chief. Under Mike Marshman, he's been harassed. He's been put on leave for 6-7 months. All kind of really bad things happen for no apparent reason. And so, because of community advocacy, he and other officers of color, ironically, who were on leave for 6-7 months, were all came back in their same jobs. But Kevin Modica announced that he will be retiring next month. And I just want, and here's why I say this is a good police officer. I've known Kevin Modica for over 20 years. And Kevin Modica, when he walks into a community room, the first thing he does is he says, "I'm Kevin Modica. I've been a Portland police officer for over 30 years, and I apologize for policing because I know it has not always worked the way it's supposed to." Once somebody does an opening like that, you are actually much more willing to listen to whatever else they have to say. My experience in talking to Portland police officers is one of two things. Either one, a total lack of acknowledgement of the harm policing has done to communities of color and low-income communities in Portland and all across the country. There's just no acknowledgement. Nope, we got a job to do, and if you don't like what we're doing, then you must be anti-cop. That's one approach they take. The other is, let's just start from today. Let's just be friends. Let's just build relationships from today on. I hear this way too much from leadership within Portland Police Bureau. There is no way to be friends today without acknowledging the past community harm that has taken place. There is no way to be friends today without doing a truth and reconciliation process. Portland police love reconciliation, but they don't love truth. And so when you do the truth part, it makes them very, very uncomfortable. And so you can't have reconciliation without truth. You've got to be honest enough to be able to say, yeah, we make mistakes, and we make mistakes pretty regularly. And working with you, we could actually fix those mistakes so that they're not so constant and so they're not so targeted to certain community members. And so to Kevin Modica, I just want to say, you know, you are a solid gentleman. You have done more to create community trust of policing than anyone else in your agency. And I wish you well in retirement because I know whatever the next journey you're on, you will bring that same integrity and honesty and openness to that process. And so when people say I'm anti-cop, I'm not anti-cop. I'm just anti-bad cop. I'm just anti-brutal cops. I'm just anti-cops who don't see the humanity in the people that they protect and serve. Those are the people that I think should not be on any police force, much less police force in the city of Portland. In the neighborhood that I live in, which is in East Portland, you know, I see the parallels. When you live here long enough, you actually see how we repeat our mistakes over and over and over again. So now that I live in East Portland, I got police for days. I got Portland police. I got Gresham police. I got Troutdale police. I got gang enforcement officers. And so in my neighborhood, you really never know what policing agency is doing police actions because they all pretty much look the same, especially when they're out of their vehicles and they do such an effective job of hiding their identification when they don't want you to know who they are. And so just like what used to be an inner Northeast Portland, when the inner Northeast Portland was predominantly African American, you couldn't get social services, but man, you could get police services for days. So there were always police agencies showing up. And so guess what? Where I live now in East Portland just happens to be the most diverse area of the city of Portland. It just happens to be the area of Portland where 63 languages are spoken. Just happens to be the area of Portland where most recent immigrant and refugees arrive and settle. And guess what? It just happens to be the area of Portland where the most policing activity takes place. And I live across the street pretty close to a Starbucks coffee shop. And, you know, I can say that on any given time, there's probably four or five police cars in that lot having coffee, hanging out, but not actually talking to the community. I mean, not doing community policing. They're actually hanging out, talking to each other, right? And they look like a gang, and they look very unapproachable. I mean, somebody like me who talks to police all the time, now I would walk up right in the middle of them and start talking. But as I look at it, I really see how unwelcoming that would look to community members who've had no experience with the police. So all you see is them racing through your neighborhood at high speed. You see five police cars stopping one individual. And so if that's your image of policing in your community, who in their right mind will walk up to five big white police officers sitting in the neighborhood and go, "Hi, my name is Joanne. What are you doing here? You know, just want to like build relationships with my community police officer." That is not a welcoming, opening environment. And so I think there should be some kind of rule that there shouldn't be more than two or three police officers having break together, so that community members, if they really did want to engage with police officers, wouldn't be intimidated and threatened by the over excessive nature of the police officers. They really do operate like a gang. And I think the more we can get them to operate less like a gang and more like community partners, the better policing will be, the safer policing will be, quite frankly. When I do Know Your Rights trainings, I make sure that I tell community members that anytime they see police action, to pull out their cell phones, to pull out their iPads, and take pictures. Because quite frankly, it makes the community members safer, and it also makes the police officers safer. Because the only thing that has ever exonerated community members has been community members' videos. It has never been a police dash cam or a police body cam has never, ever exonerated a community member. And of course, you know, hopefully we won't be investing in that useless technology of body cams in Portland because of the great job that Charlie Hales did giving away any sense of accountability. You might remember one of his last acts was to sign a brand new contract and give police officers permission to review any video before writing their written report. My blood pressure still goes up when I think about that, because for a decade, we tried to do away with the 48-hour rule in the police contract that gave police officers 48 hours to calm down before they would give a statement after they shot someone or used excessive force against someone. So that did get removed. But what Charlie Hales replaced it with was giving police the ability to review any video footage of their police action before writing their written report. Why do police need to see video before writing reports? We've been doing policing since the early 1900s in the city of Portland. Police officers know how to write on paper. The only reason to give police officers that ability is so that they can write their statements to match what we see in the video. And so why would we trust anything that was written after a police officer saw the video? But Charlie Hales went further than that. He didn't just give them an opportunity to review the video before writing a written report, and then said in a timely manner, so no timeline. He also gave them the ability to review any video if they're under investigation. Hopefully, maybe this city council will have the political courage to fix that, but I doubt it. And so we have been... It's amazing how quickly time goes when your blood pressure's up, when you are fired up about issues that are taking place in the community. It is your opportunity to stay engaged, stay involved in this search for the next police chief. This is the most critical hire that the city of Portland is going to do in quite some time. And it impacts each and every one of us who live in this community. So please pay attention. When asked to come out and participate, participate. Coming up today on the Boo at 9 is Press Watch. Teresa Mitchell brings you the news you're not supposed to know. At 10, Eric Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. 10:15, Flashpoint with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, between the covers, David Nymor speaks to Pulitzer Prize winner Gregory Paulo about his book Digest, which draws from the present and past to form an intellectual American identity. Want to thank KBOO members for your generous support during our last pledge drive. If you haven't joined yet, just go to kboo.fm and click on donate. I am Joanne Hardesty. It's been my pleasure. You have a fabulous day. See you next week, same time, same place, same station. Have a great day.
Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Don't give up the fight.
Preacher man, don't tell me heaven is under the earth. You don't know what life is really worth. It's an all that glitters gold. After story had never been told. So now you see the light. Hey, stand up for your right.
And good morning, it is KBOO Portland. 1 minute before 9 o'clock. Coming up in an hour, join us for Air Cascadia with headlines, interviews, and commentary. And then at 10:15, we'll have Flashpoints for you with Dennis Bernstein. At 11 today on Between the Covers, David Naiman will be speaking to Pulitzer Prize winner Gregory Pardlow about his book Digest, which draws from the present and the past to form an intellectual American identity. Up next, though, it is Press Watch. Teresa Mitchell is here bringing you the news you're not supposed to know. Stick around. That is coming up next on KBOO.
Girl, KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Next Level 3.0's party, Vogue Beach Please, on Saturday, July 1st from 9 p.m. to 2 a.m. at Tonic Lounge in Portland. Next Level 3.0 is a collaboration with Flawless Shade, the House of Flora, and the House of Ada, featuring KBOO's Dina B and DJ Gila River Monster, and more DJs and performers. Costumes are highly recommended. Again, that's Next Level 3.0's party, Vogue Beach Please, on Saturday, July 1st from 9 p.m. to 2 a.m. at the Tonic Lounge, 3100 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.